Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This war has many fronts, of course, one of which is of particular concern at the moment, and that is what is happening in the Middle East, specifically the various incredibly dynamic developments associated with what appears to be the liquidation of a Saudi national who had permanent legal status in the United States, Jamal Khashoggi. We are told that he was offed by people working for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Many are calling for some dramatic redirection of U.S. policy towards the Saudis. It is high time to call back one of our duty experts on these sorts of matters, Danielle Pletka. She is a senior vice president for foreign and defense policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a place she has resided for some time since, as I recall, leaving Senator Jesse Helms's employ up on Capitol Hill. She's been a remarkable source of information and analysis, particularly on the Middle East, for many years, and it's always a delight to have her with us. We see her more often elsewhere, notably on the Sunday shows. But Danny, thank you for joining us at Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you back.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. I always have a hard time living up to your introductions, Frank.
You do handsomely. So let's talk about this Khashoggi deal. You've written now in a number of places about, you know, the importance of minding our values as we deal with this very ugly business, but also our interests. Tell us what you think each require.
So I think it's important to start off exactly where you started, Frank, which is that this is, if what happened is what has been very widely reported, which is that the Saudi national went into his own nation's consulate in Istanbul, where he was trapped and murdered and disposed of by a squad sent from Riyadh, then that deserves outright condemnation, no matter what our interests are. You know, countries that work with the United States, but also our adversaries, should know that this kind of thing is absolutely intolerable, unacceptable, and frankly, it doesn't make a difference whether he was a green card holder, a resident alien in the United States, or he was a complete foreigner. Countries should not be engaged in murdering their citizens at home, abroad, or anywhere else. So that's sort of where you start. And that's a value statement. And the fact that the Saudis were surprised at the reaction is actually a lesson for us, because they obviously did not get the memo that the United States frowns upon anyone doing this. Not just the Saudis, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Turks themselves. This is, of course, the irony of this story. So that is truly unacceptable. Now, and then you have to separate it out. And this is the question you asked about values and interests. Number one, those are our values. We need to be absolutely crystal clear about that. On the other hand, those who have said, we can no longer work with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is absolutely anathema to us now. And as long as Mohammed bin Salman is the crown prince, we cannot engage with them in any way. That seems to me to be a little ridiculous, frankly. Saudi Arabia is an important country. It is instrumental to us in our long-term battle against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And if we could have disposed of Saudi Arabia easily because there were plenty of other allies to turn to, I would say perhaps that is a rational consideration. That is not the case. There is not another country in the region that we can stand with against the Iranians that can as importantly represent an Arab voice. So, you know, some people might say, we've got Israel. Well, yes, but Israel does not speak for 300 million Arabs.
And I think Israel would be the first to say, we'd just as soon have the Saudis on our side as we stand up to the Iranians. And this really comes to the question that I wanted to get at specifically with you, Danny. You, again, are a specialist in the region, and you understand that the backdrop to much of this, if not indeed some of the impetus behind it, is the fault line between, on the one hand, Sunni Arab nations, more or less led by Saudi Arabia, on the one hand, and the non-Arab nations like Turkey and certainly Iran, an Arab nation, but one that hangs with them much more often than with the Saudis, the Qataris, and then this outfit, the Muslim Brotherhood. And the question that I have to you is, would American interests be served if we were coming out of this exercise effectively rewarding the Turks, the Qataris, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Iranians, as we set about punishing the Saudis?
It's the perfect question. And it what it demands is a foreign policy that actually has a little nuance. You know that old hackneyed phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That is a very bad guide to foreign policy.
Frequently, because the enemy of your enemy is your enemy.
Exactly. And, you know, remember that famous line about the Iran-Iraq war? I think it was Henry Kissinger, although it might have been someone else who said, can't say both.
Yeah, no, it was Kissinger.
that's exactly right. Look, the Turks are sort of trying to burnish their image through this very principled opposition to the murder.
Shocked
to find out that there's murder going on in a consulate where they clearly had bugs and spies and everything else. And of course, this obscures to many people the fact that that Turkey and not Saudi Arabia is the country in the world with the most journalists in prison.
And not a few disappeared altogether, I think it's fair to say.
That's exactly right. Look, the Turkish government has been engaged in the systematic suppression of human freedoms at an escalating pace over the last two decades, which is extraordinarily troubling. And Erdogan has, in fact, set himself up as the godfather, so to speak, of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East and the axe they have to grind with Saudi Arabia.
Godfather may be more apt than you mean, but it also coincides, I think it's fair to say, that trajectory of internal repression with their increasing enmity towards the United States and aligning with Iran and the Russians and the Chinese and others, no?
Yeah, exactly. No, this is the challenge for us. And of course, this is actually a challenge for NATO. People forget that while we increasingly think of Turkey as part of the problems of the Middle East, in fact, it is the country that is NATO's southern flank, and NATO has no mechanism with which to manage a dangerous government in our midst.
You know, we published a book recently to this point entitled Turkey, Ally No More. And Danny Pletzke, we have to leave it at this for the moment, but I hope you'll come back and talk with us about what do you do about a problem like Turkey, not least because, as you say, it's not only a challenge to us in the Middle East, but also, of course, it's been responsible for much of the problems that we've been having with illegal immigration into Europe, which is so riven and otherwise traumatized the rest of our NATO allies. We have to leave it at that. Danny Pletzke from the American Enterprise Institute, thank you for your counsel today, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's my delight to say that Charles Sam Faddis is in the house. Sam is a very highly accomplished former Central Intelligence Agency clandestine service officer, also known as a spy or spook. He has served our country in some extraordinarily dangerous places, including the Middle East, South Asia, and even Europe. He has been, of late, working for Artemis as a senior partner, and he is a senior editor with And Magazine. And he caught my eye the other day for an important piece, I guess it's actually several pieces now, that he has written at And Magazine about the invasion, as he correctly calls it. He says, this is not immigration, this caravan business. This is an invasion. Sam, it's good to have you back. Thank you for your clarity on this point. It's not much in evidence elsewhere at the moment, is it? Tell us a little bit about how you see the provenance of this operation and what that tells us about the true purpose behind it.
So basically, you know, I was sitting here roughly a week ago, like everybody else, watching the news coverage of this so-called caravan. And I guess the explanation is that spontaneously thousands of Central Americans just stood up one day and all started walking north like something out of a science fiction film.
The zombies.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, you know, okay, well, that's not the way the world works, and that defies common sense and logic. And since none of these so-called news outlets are actually going to bother to figure out what's going on, maybe I'll do some digging. Back in the day, that would have meant I would have, you know, been on the ground in Central America, but, you know.
Now you can do it with a click of a mouse, right?
You know, it took me all of a couple of sessions over the space of about 24 hours rooting around to determine that it is very clear. In fact, the folks involved have admitted this and posted on their social media and given interviews about it, that there are organizers from a party called Libre who put this thing together. Libre is a typical Central American Marxist socialist outfit, basically the creation of Manuel Zelaya, who once upon a time wanted to make himself dictator for life in Honduras. And all these guys are, of course, in bed with all the usual suspects, meaning the Venezuelans, the Cubans.
Probably the Iranians.
Well, by extension, yeah, we should all recall that if you're in bed with the Venezuelans, since they are in bed with Hezbollah, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and everybody else, that's a pretty unsavory mix. And these are the folks who, by their own admission, have put together this thing on the social media. You know, you look on the Facebook page, is literally of the guys that were involved in doing this, and they're bragging about it and posting video and photographs from the march as they're moving. So there is, in fact, no great mystery here now.
But it still has to be exposed. And what you've pointed out is there's an awful lot of reluctance to do that, apparently, on the part of the so-called mainstream press.
You know, once upon a time, I would have used that word, Frank, reluctance, and given them the benefit of the doubt. I have reached a point in watching what is unfolding that it has become clear to me, at least, that this is a deliberate, premeditated decision to not just, they don't want to expose it, they are actually actively covering it up. We published an article about this in AND, and then just as a routine measure, as you typically do on the magazine website, on the Facebook page, attempted to boost the post, right? That's a small amount of change to just basically advertise the post. Facebook immediately refused to allow us to do that, citing its political content.
Can't have that, at least if it's at odds with its leftist preferences, right?
Well, I mean, you just wonder, given the torrent of information on Facebook, obviously they are not individually monitoring every article. So this is an algorithm. They are searching for keywords on posts. So this was not an article on child pornography or drug smuggling that you would have expected to have tripped alarms. This was an article about a caravan, and all it said was, hey, sorry to burst your bubble, but this thing is organized and directed and led by known Marxists in bed with the Venezuelans and everybody else. And that apparently, well, not apparently, that was too incendiary.
Yeah. So, Sam, let me ask you, the president has come in for a fair amount of criticism, shall we say, for having observed that there are likely Middle Easterners, perhaps drug traffickers or cartel members or other criminal gang members or terrorists even, in this cohort that's swollen now to some 7,000 people in, I guess, the first caravan. There seem to be some others that are forming up as well. Knowing what you do about these sorts of elements, shall we call them, on the radical left, coming out of places like Marxist parties in Central America with all of their allies, How reasonable a bet is it that there are such people in this caravan?
Well, I think that is undoubtedly true, although I would assume that the vast majority of people are just simply folks that, as usual, are being used as pawns.
Women and children, most especially.
Exactly, who are just being led.
Human shields, we might say.
Exactly, functionally human shields. But really, when you think about this, it's so much worse than just having some drug traffickers in this, because Venezuela, Central American Marxist parties, Hezbollah, not only are all of these individuals involved in terrorism, but they are involved in drug trafficking on a massive scale. I mean, these are, in fact, folks that are completely in bed with cartels and terrorist groups. The Venezuelans, for instance, have been implicated in providing false documents directly to Hezbollah. This is not, there are a couple of guys there and they're not being particularly vigorous in going after them. They are completely in bed with this. That's what you have, a caravan directed, organized, and run by folks who are involved in all these things.
Well, so this is no kidding, a threat to public safety on this side of the border and arguably national security. It would fully qualify, I think it's reasonable to say, as a result, as an invasion. And so, Sam Faddis, you've spent a lot of time in the black arts of the world of espionage, dealing with unsavory sorts and trying to counteract them, often cleverly and out of the public eye. What would you be recommending now? The president has said they're not coming in. He is threatening to close the border. He is, I believe, set in train, plans to put military personnel on the border to protect it, which seems to me sensible. But what would you recommend actually be done? Because all other things being equal, let's be honest, it's almost certainly the case that we're going to have those women and children first being pushed forward by all of these other characters, including some unsavory ones. And the optics, the video, particularly in this hypercharged political environment, is likely to be pretty ugly. What would you recommend be done?
Well, I think you put your finger there at the end on something very critical, which is the optics of this. So the first thing I would recommend is we turn on all the lights. I mean, that's what you do when you have cockroaches, right? So if in the space of a couple of days of work, Sam Faddis remote from the United States can find this much information on these guys, one would hope to God that our intelligence apparatus ought to be able to find chapter and verse on them. And we ought to lay that out in front of the world and make them and expose them for what they are. Because the first thing that would do would be make people at home have to make a clear decision on which side you're on. I mean, if you want to be on the side of the Marxists, that's fine, but you're going to have to stand up in broad daylight and say that clearly. You're not going to be able to hide.
Well, given the number of socialists that are now running for office, there may be a fairly large percentage that'll buy into this. But again, it's not just Marxists who have their toxic political agenda. It's people who are doing drug trafficking and carteling.
Well, I mean, my God, the other day, Senator Ben Cardin here in the state of Maryland actually came out, a sitting United States senator, not that this really surprises me knowing Ben, but and said, we should actually be reaching out and helping this caravan reach the United States. Well, at least let's make Ben Cardin have to say in broad daylight that what he means by that is he wants us to assist a Marxist invasion and deny him the cover. But beyond that, I think the president's 100% correct. They don't cross. And I would, frankly, if that means we close the Mexican border for several days, then close the Mexican border, because that will also have the effect of demonstrating to the Mexicans that they might want to think about the game they're playing.
There are real costs, yeah. But by closing the border, that would simply mean you shut down the border crossing points, the bridges and the like. But there's a lot of border out there, as you know better than most, Sam Faddis. When you look at that, the number of people the president apparently is talking about summoning to go down there and defend it. I'm told it's something on the order of 800. That won't do. There's obviously Border Patrol officers, and I'm told there are also militiamen that are forming up. But still, at some point, push is going to come to shove in all likelihood. And I just wonder if you have any particular tricks of the trade that you would say might be used to disable such border crossings before that becomes a potentially violent effort to block them.
You know, I don't think there are any tricks you're going to need if you really want to do this and you really want to close the border. You're obviously going to need a hell of a lot more than 800 guys added to this. But I think that as long as this occurs, I mean, send as many people as you need. And as long as it occurs in the context of it being said over and over clearly every day, this is the reality of what is happening. Therefore, the country understands who organized and directed this.
Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that. I trust you will be monitoring the situation closely and that you will be willing to come back and give us updates. Thank you for your time, Sam, as well as your service to our country. I know you will keep it up at Artemis and End Magazine.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
It's good to be back with my dear friend and much admired comrade in arms, one of Europe's great freedom fighters, Katie Hopkins. She is, among other things, reckon all this, an award-winning documentary maker, a columnist for national newspapers, a radio talk show host, a best-selling author, and a woman who has been extraordinarily effective in showcasing the challenges that her own country, Great Britain, but the free world more generally, including South Africa and nations on the continent of Europe and our own beloved America, are now facing at the hands of what I think of as the red-green axis, the radical left, and its unlikely allies in the camp of Sharia supremacism. It is always an exciting time to visit with Katie, and I'm so pleased to be able to do so. Though the reason that we're speaking, I'm sorry to say, is not a happy occasion. It is a subject that we'll talk about with her right now. Katie Hopkins, thank you so much for coming back, and welcome as always.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So let's talk about our friend Elizabeth Sabadish Wolf. I think of her also as a freedom fighter hailing from Austria. What is the latest on Elizabeth?
Yes, so lovely Elizabeth. Back in 2009, Elizabeth gave a couple of seminars, about 12 hours worth of content, and she was talking about Islam, and she questioned, you know, the marriage of Prophet Muhammad to a six-year-old, which was consummated at the age of nine. And she asked the question, I think rightfully and thoughtfully, if this isn't paedophilia, then what is it? You know, what is this? Now, that's progressed. It's gone through the court. She was prosecuted. She was fined for saying that. And she, you know, had a criminal record. She's pursued that all the way through to the European Court of Human Rights. And just yesterday, the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, said that actually that judgment against her, the fact that she was prosecuted for raising that question, was fair. That judgment was upheld. And the reason they gave, the verdict they gave, or the ruling, was that someone's religious feelings matter more or carry greater significance, in effect, than Elizabeth's freedom of speech under Article 10. So it's a point of detail what actually went on, what Elizabeth said, the prosecution that followed. But the big message, the big takeaway for your listeners, particularly in America, is this is a European court ruling that says the rights of Muslims not to be offended are now more significant, are greater than the rights of a European woman to speak freely. And that should sound the alarm.
Yeah, it should sound the alarm indeed. Because, and you've studied these matters closely, I know you have yourself been embroiled in some controversies over the years by virtue of having spoken freely and I think quite responsibly and articulately, needless to say, about challenges that Britain is facing in some of these same regards. But specifically, if I'm not mistaken, what has just happened is that this so-called European Court of Human Rights has upheld what amount to Sharia blasphemy restrictions and applied them in Europe. And it wouldn't just be in Elisabeth Sabadish Wolf's native Austria. It would be, I assume, across the entire European Union, including your own country for the moment. But this would essentially be a suppression of freedom of speech to this barbaric, totalitarian code that faithful Muslims are told they must adhere to, right?
Absolutely. And I think what's really chilling about this, if we take this forwards, if we play this out, so if we are therefore having Sharia law enforced at the European Court of Human Rights, as this ruling suggests, then of course it helps to part explain why, for example, Brittany Pettibone, Martin Selner and others were kept out of the UK on the basis of future hate speech as yet unsaid that might impact on local communities.
This was by the British government, I take it.
The British government made that decision to keep them out on the basis of future speech as yet unsaid. And I think if you start to join these dots together, someone prosecuted for something they did say, a ruling that says, well, actually, the rights of Muslims not to be offended matters more. And then people kept out of the UK, law-abiding citizens kept out of the UK in case they might say something. You know, that's the path we're headed down. And obviously, we use this phrase, you know, Frank, really loosely. Oh, the freedom of speech. I defend the freedom of speech. You know, I think we have to accept and acknowledge there is no freedom to speak in Europe in 2018, because that's the point we're at.
So if I may ask this question of you, Katie, while we're still able to speak to you on the phone, how do you see this bearing on your own ability to speak in Her Majesty's kingdom? And are you at risk if you exit at any point, not being allowed back in because of something you've actually said or something you might say?
Yes, I think there's always a risk. And for any of us in this fight, and many of us are in this fight together, there is a fine line. And sometimes we'll get that fine line, not necessarily wrong, but sometimes we'll cross their fine line because we never know quite where it is. But how I feel about it, and one of the positives I take from this, is Elisabeth Sabadich Wolf was not wrong in what she said. And in many ways, since 2009, people have become awakened to the threat from Islam. That number is growing. And we are part of a very large family fighting back. And there is still time for us to stop America falling as we have fallen. And that's really what I'm all about, what you're about. The cause that we fight for now is to save America and to try and slow the rate of fall here. And if that means that some of us are prosecuted, then so be it.
Yeah. Well, I commend you for that. That certainly is courageous. And I do want to come back in a moment to the situation here in the United States and the lessons of what's going on there. But just to drill down for one more moment, Katie Hopkins, we've watched with horror what has happened to Tommy Robinson, one of your countrymen who was thrown into prison under pretty harsh conditions, in fact, for considerable reason to fear for his own life, in a population of Muslims who were in jail, presumably for, among other things, their jihadism. Tommy has fortunately been released from jail, but obviously that was a chilling sign of where Her Majesty's government is on these things, the courts in the United Kingdom. Just again, to ask the question specifically, do you believe now that effectively you and others in Britain are going to be facing this kind of, well, I would call it persecution, not just prosecution, with a British government that is reinforced in its misconduct in this regard by this ruling by the European Court?
Absolutely. I can see the trajectory we're on with Tommy Robinson, for example. And there was something deeply, if I could just say, from an emotional perspective, a sort of sinister about the way that Tommy was scooped off the streets where he was repeating information already in the public domain. The judge was at the window observing that happen. There was something very sinister and calculating about all of that. And I think we all see that that's part of what we are now up against. I think there is certainly a feeling of persecution. I think this court ruling absolutely gives the establishment and the judiciary every reason to say that if you go against that, if you are in danger of causing offence to the Muslim community, that's reason enough to put you away inside. And so I think that's where we now sit in the UK, is we sit under that ruling.
Okay, well, so to come to the United States, and you have often, and I hope you will again in the near future, Katie Hopkins, but to bring the topic back to what are the lessons for us? We, of course, have our revered First Amendment, which guarantees, as a God-given, unalienable right, freedom of speech. You don't have that. You don't have it in your own, you know, charter, the Magna Carta, I guess, going back to that. You don't have it in this so-called European convention. It's simply different fundamentally in terms of what is something that is divinely authorized, if you will, and something the state can give you or take away from you at will. Should we nonetheless fear in this country this trajectory that you've just described, specifically because here we are already hearing from not only the Sharia supremacists and their allies on the left, but others, including in the press, amazingly enough, that this all gives rise to hate speech and must be silenced. Should we, in fact, be to arms, at least figuratively, about the need to protect our freedom of speech?
Absolutely. Yes, I think it's too, if we wait to react, as we've seen here in the UK, in Western Europe, wherever, it's too late. What we have to do is get on the offensive about free speech. And in many ways, if I was a mother now in America with a new family, the first book, or as a grandmother maybe at my age now, the first book I would buy for any child of mine or grandchild would be the Constitution. I would write in it, I'd write them a message, and I would put it by their bedside, because I really feel that that is something that we definitely don't have in the UK, but seems fundamental to everything that may protect you going forward in the United States. And I think the other thing that really matters in the United States is to observe very keenly the ability of the other side, as I would call it, of care, of the Muslim community,
the Muslim Brotherhood,
exactly, their ability to speak freely. And that seems to be unchallenged.
Katie Hopkins, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this saga will continue, I'm afraid, on both sides of the pond, and we will be turning to you for more counsel in the near future. I hope you will be over here shortly helping us raise the alarm as well.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by George Raisley. He is a friend and colleague who I've admired for a very long time. He has served in senior positions in the United States government, including notably as an aide to then Vice President Dan Quayle in the George H.W. Bush administration. These days, he is the editor of a terrific online publication, Conservative HQ. He is, among other things, a Mensa certified genius. We don't hold that against him. In fact, we think that's a rather remarkable testimony to what we would otherwise just say is inherently brilliant thinking on subjects, including the comments that he has made just today at Conservative HQ about what he calls fake bombs, fake news. George Raisley, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Frank. It sounds like you're reading a bio by my mom.
No, it's I think authentic, and probably Wikipedia even would have it. Listen, George, I wrote myself just a tweet, I think, when these pipe bombs started turning up the other day, and it precipitated the most virulent and voluminous attacks on me that I have had to date. This is something of a personal best, I guess you'd say, because I was even entertaining the idea that in the course of an investigation, we need to not only find out who was responsible for this series now of pipe bombs, as they're called, being sent through the mail or otherwise to various prominent Democratic figures, but also find out why they did it, and specifically whether this might have been meant as a deflection from the fact that I think without exception, these people have been promoting at the very least the kind of revolt against the Trump presidency, if not an overt call for disturbances at a minimum, and in some cases, what certainly sounded like calls to violence in others. In other words, that this may have a lot to do with trying to change such folks from being perpetrators of the kind of rabid political rhetoric that they're now denouncing, and transform them immediately into perceived victims. Talk us through what we know about these so-called bombs at this point, and what raises alarms for you about all of this as well?
Well, I think starting with number one, former CIA Director John Brennan said a couple of days ago, he knows there's more bombs coming because he hasn't gotten one. And the very next day, he gets one.
Albeit at CNN, which he didn't work for.
Mm-hmm. Strange that CNN gets a bomb and opens it and films it instead of running for cover.
This is at the same time, as I understand it, that the block of office buildings were being emptied in response to this apparent threat. It seems a little peculiar, doesn't it?
Also, just from a technical perspective, the bombs, or the purported bombs, I should call them, have digital timers prominently displayed on them, but these timers have no alarm function, meaning that they would be useless to detonate the bomb from a technical perspective.
You could tell time with them, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, you could tell time and stuff like that. It's also kind of strange that the they're all sent to people that don't open their own mail. And I said facetiously that maybe the bomb maker was after George Soros's butler or the mailroom clerk at CNN rather than the addressee. But I think the larger point is something that you touched on, and it's really, to me, these are indicative of psyops. You know, they are a form of terrorism, but they're intended, as you said, to change the narrative. And, of course, suddenly the caravan of invaders heading for our southern border has disappeared from the TV news. The actual violence perpetrated by Democrats has disappeared from the TV news, and fake violence created in, to my mind, or rather likely created by someone on the left is now dominating the news.
Yeah. Let's just stipulate here, George, because the investigation is underway. We don't know who is responsible, and what we are surmising on the basis of evidence like that you've presented is that this doesn't quite add up to a serious attack aimed at trying to murder, at minimum, silence these critics of Donald Trump. And what I'm struck by as well, which I think also needs to be just in a, well, an informed conversation about what's going on here, is every single one of these individuals, including Maxine Waters, who literally was calling for attacks on, you know, cabinet officers and the like, if only of the, you know, up close and personal, in your face rhetorical attacks, but very much, you know, calling for that. Hillary Clinton, insisting that there would be no civility until she and her friends were back in power. And Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of the United States, calling for kicking people. Again, a pretty direct call for physical violence. But here's the thing, George. All of these people have suddenly been transformed into folks who are now able to say, along with their media echo chamber, well, this is all Donald Trump's fault. That would seem to be a sort of classic political jujitsu, which I simply think you can't rule out the possibility that that may have something to do with why this was perpetrated. What do you think?
Yeah, and that's exactly, you know, what I said in the piece, that, you know, we need to take a deep breath and allow law enforcement to do its job and find out the facts. And when the facts are found out, then we'll have a greater opportunity to judge what the motivations are. But until that time, I think we need to be skeptical of the establishment media and people on the left who, you know, are immediately blaming Trump for this.
Yeah, well, and hyperventilating about the fact that he must stop. And this would seem to be part of, again, a plausible explanation for why this was done. We saw him hold a rally the day the pipe bombs turned up, in which he, you know, was reading from the teleprompter, as has been pointed out, and not whipping up the crowd in a way that would clearly translate into political benefit for his opponents. George, you had a fabulous quote in this piece at, and again, we're speaking with George Raceley, the editor of Conservative HQ. And you can find his writings at conservativehq.com. And this particular piece entitled Fake Bombs, Fake News has a quote from Scott Adams, as you say, of Dilbert fame, to the effect of, quote, if the bomber theories come down to either a crazy Republican or a super clever Democrat false flag mission, one of those things is far more common than the other, unquote. And then you go on to note that would be the Democratic false flag missions. You just give us a little bit of a short course on other examples of how we've seen that kind of false flag activity from that quarter in the past.
Yeah, there are literally dozens of examples of Muslims claiming anti-Muslim violence that were false.
So this would not necessarily be technically Democrats, but it's part of the what I call the red-green axis with the left, for sure.
And one of those, in fact, was made against our friend Patrick Poole. We have liberal race activists claiming racist incidents by, you know, conservatives, and Al Sharpton and Tawana Brawley being the most obvious one. A woman just was sentenced to a jail term for making up a homophobic attack, and it goes on and on and on. And so the left is, you know, going back to the Haymarket bombing, is very adept at these false flag operations. It's part of their toolkit.
George Raceley, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is extraordinarily helpful. I know you'll be following the story closely at Conservative HQ, and that you'll be coming back to us, I trust, in due course with further updates. I hope the rest of you will be coming back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.